13 days, 19 hours, 10 minutes, and 32 seconds. To most people, that's about 2 weeks. But to someone racing 16 dogs across the frozen Alaskan wilderness, those seconds count. The Iditarod begins again next week. Many who start the famously grueling over 1,000-mile race won't reach the finish line. Our guest today has been there. Her new memoir is Fast Into the Night, A Woman, Her Dogs, and Their Journey North on the Iditarod Trail. In it, we glimpse the days, the seconds, the minutes, the hours, and the years required to complete that trail. Debbie Clark Motoreau, welcome to The Exchange.
Well, thanks so much, Emily. It's great to be talking to you.
Yeah, great to have you here. So your book is an exciting peek into a rather extreme sport. Before we armchair adventurers get to learn all about the Iditarod, I'd like to learn a little bit more about how you got there. It's the late 1970s, and you've relocated from the East Coast to Wyoming, intending to stay. You and your then-boyfriend plan a mountaineering trip to Alaska, but he bails on you, and you decide to go. So how does that become a critical decision in your life?
Well, things happen when you don't expect them to. I decided to go anyway. I was certainly not interested in romance at that point whatsoever. And, of course, I met my husband after having landed at the airport about an hour earlier.
Oh, okay.
He joined us on the mountain climbing trip, and I'd already made a pretty big geographic move from the East Coast to Wyoming. So moving from Wyoming to Alaska when I was 24 years old didn't seem like any big deal at all. So I moved up pretty quickly.
And your husband, Mark, who you met on that trip, he already had dog sledding in his family and in his life, correct?
No, he didn't. He was a mountain climber. But our first dog walked through our door when our children were 5 and 6. And I just had 2 mid-pregnancy miscarriages. I was really down in the dumps. And an Iditarod musher brought us over a present, as he put it. I objected. I didn't even want to be cheered up. But Ernie Willis brought over a 7-year-old white Alaskan husky. And that was really our entry into the sport.
And what was her name or his name?
The dog's name was Salt.
Salt.
And I fell in love with Salt immediately. I had been a fairly competitive alpine skier throughout my childhood up in Vermont. And, well, I don't know how competitive I was, but I thought I was.
Right. You cared about winning. That's competitive.
I cared about doing the best I could do. And I was dedicated, let's put it that way. And so here I am, essentially depressed, although I never would have admitted it. And this dog just had to go outside and go and run. And so I put on my climbing harness and attached a rope to it, and we went ski-touring together. And he fixed my morale in no time, and the rest of our young family fell in love with this dog and the sport.
And so we begin with one dog and a harness and you on a pair of skis, and some years later, that's going to be 16 dogs at the starting line of probably the most famous dog sledding event in the world. In that journey, which you cover in your memoir, Fast Into the Night, did you learn a lot about Alaska's dog sledding history and where this was coming from?
Well, it's everywhere up here. You know, the Iditarod starts this Saturday, and it's sort of like New Year's for us, particularly those of us in the sport. People are coming in from literally all over the world. I have many friends that are running Iditarod, some just to finish. Some are on their second and third try to finish. And others of our friends are going to be up there in the front of the pack trying to win. But behind all of it is a lifestyle and a history in this land with long winters that really plays into everything we do and how we do it, whether it's our breed of dogs that have been bred over decades and decades and centuries, or the trail, in many cases, the trail is the historic Iditarod trail that Joe Reddington Sr. Really wanted to preserve when he founded the race back in 1973.
And so the dogs themselves, what breed is most suited for this? Is it 1,000 miles somewhere in that ballpark?
Yeah, the race is 1,000 miles, and the dogs that most mushers use are Alaskan huskies. They are mutts. They've been, like I said, bred and for many, many years to be well-suited for this. And they love to go.
So you call them mutts. Is that because dogs that are good get, our bread, and it's just selecting for talent and not so much for the lineage. Or did I miss?
No, I mean that they're not pure breeds. They're uh-huh. they're not a registered purebred. Like they are not. There are Siberian Husky teams, which is an AKC registered, you know, breed.
Oh, I see.
Our dogs are not. They've been bred to include in many cases, although it's not all the same. There's some pointer in them, perhaps. There's hounds. There might be Siberian Huskies or Malamutes, but they're a mixed breed. That's what I meant by mutt. Sorry.
Well, and so I love them. I love a good mutt. I got to tell you, how does the look of an Alaskan Husky differ from, for me, I'm a little bit more familiar with what a Siberian Husky looks like. They have a pretty iconic image around the world, but the dogs on the cover of your book, to me, they look a little svelter.
Yep.
Yeah. And how, other ways?
Well, my dogs are on the small side of Alaskan Huskies, although they're very competitive teams that have dogs about the size of ours. Our dogs, those two girls in lead, one weighed probably 38, the other 45. That's Kanga and Juliet, in that picture on the cover of my book. But, our dogs, we don't breed often, but we have had litters, particularly in recent years. The dogs come out all different colors, ears up, ears down, floppy ears. They're very colorful and very varied, team to team and actually litter to litter.
And so how many dogs on a sled in the Iditarod? Does it vary or is there a set number there?
Well, the standard is to start with 16 dogs. You're welcome to start with fewer. The reason most people start with 16 is that it's a very long way. And there are 22 checkpoints along the way where we send out food and provisions for the dogs and ourselves. And there are veterinarians at each checkpoint. So every step along the way, dogs, you have an opportunity to leave dogs in the hands of veterinarians to send home if they're in heat, if they're a little sore, they're just not having fun.
So
but you can't add dogs.
You can't substitute dogs once you start the race.
Right. You only can leave them.
All right. So much more to talk about with Debbie Clark Modereau. Her new memoir is Fast Into the Night, A Woman, Her Dogs, and Their Journey North on the Iditarod Trail. I'm Emily Curitan, and this is the Jefferson Exchange. We will be back with more talk of the Iditarod and dog sledding. You are welcome to join the conversation. Phone number and email address are on the way after a short break. On the Jefferson Exchange with Debbie Clark Modereau, author of Fast Into the Night, about her journey on the Iditarod Trail with 16 Alaskan Huskies. I'm Emily Curitan. You can join the conversation, 800-838-3760, or email us jx@jeffnet.org. Debbie, we were just talking about how many dogs are in a sled and the type of dogs that you use for the Iditarod. What makes a leader in an Iditarod dog?
Well, the leaders, of course, are the dogs that go out at the front of the line. And they're the ones that you depend on to set the tone, set the speed, although the musher can slow it down, which we often do, and really just have that confidence to be eager for the next turn in the trail and to communicate that to the others behind them.
And when you're on this trail, how do you wayfind in the snow and the fog and the ice?
Well, Alaskan weather can throw tricks at you in with very little warning. But before the Iditarod begins, a group of super dedicated volunteers go out on snowmobiles and set the trail. And they put in over 5,000 markers between Anchorage or Willow,
like
Alaska.
Like flagging tape or something?
They look like garden lathes. They're wooden stakes. The top of them are painted orange. And then there's reflective tape at the base of, say, 6 inches of orange paint and a blue tag on them.
Uh-huh.
Because at different places, the Iditarod Trail coincides with trails for other purposes. And so as a musher, you really do have to watch your step that you don't get off on somebody else's trail. So you know those Iditarod markers, and the dogs come to know them as well.
Now, you and your dog, you've run in the race twice. What was the high and low temperature, just to kind of get us there, get us to this place? On those 2 weeks in March, starts again this year on Saturday, how cold are we talking?
Well, the potential is that it can get very cold. You know, I don't think I saw much. It happens that both my Iditarods were not that cold. So the coldest was probably 30 below, but you add wind. You add wind to that. I know, for where you are, that's really cold. you add wind to anything below zero, and that's a pretty serious situation. Unfortunately, the highs on the race were quite high, say mid-40s, and those are the temperatures our dogs do not do well in. Uh-huh. So when it gets warm like that, we usually run at night when the sun isn't out, and the dogs love running in darkness, hence the title of my book, because Fast Into the Night. It's not that I was trying to go so fast. It's that the dogs were going faster than I wanted into darkness. That became very common.
Because of the warm conditions.
Well, we run around the clock anyway. The point of the thing is to train to find that sweet spot, that run-rest cadence, where you'll run 6 hours, rest 6 hours, run 7 hours, rest 5 hours, run 8 hours, rest 6 hours. That sort of thing. And you do run through the night. And you do, as a musher, have to be prepared to sleep in small segments when it's best for your dogs to be resting. They get much more rest than we do. But now when it's in the 40s during the day, you might take an extra long rest in the day and take an extra long run during the night.
So you might be in a single 24-hour period, you could face 30 below and windy and then 40 above?
I mean, definitely there's that potential. You know, every weather mm-hmm. system ends, and this is the time of year where there's some pretty significant swings in the weather.
Right. And so the first year that you attempted the Iditarod in 2003, the conditions were a little different from past races, weren't they?
They were. We had very little snow that winter, which meant it was really hard to train. And at the last minute, they moved the route to a unique route. The only time it's ever been run exactly in the same manner was that year. In 2003, the race started in Fairbanks and really followed the major interior river systems for 1,100 miles.
So why did they have to change the route?
Mostly because the rivers in south central Alaska, where the race usually begins, had not frozen up. And so that makes the trail impassable.
It sounds like a scary element to introduce, too, if you're basically flying blind or flying by 16 noses rather than your eyes.
Well, the dogs are pretty savvy. The race isn't going to put you on a trail that they on a river that they think is going to break up. I mean, that is nobody's choice. And that's why they made the conservative decision to start in Fairbanks. But our weather is getting warmer and warmer up here. So last year, the race began in Fairbanks as well. It did follow a slightly different route.
Is there discussion of starting the race earlier, or is this first week, second week in March, married to the tradition?
I think it's married to the tradition. I mean, that's my sense. I guess I don't know that. This winter starting earlier wouldn't have made any difference. We've had an incredibly warm winter.
So when you began in 2003, I'm thinking of the river breaking up. And for me, in reviewing your new memoir, Fast Into the Night, I had a kind of a heart racing moment just thinking about this. when you were talking about shining your headlamp around and then realizing that you don't even want to know. Because if you're going past open water, you don't want to see it. And if you're running right for it, there's nothing you can do about it. So where did your mind and the light of your mind go in moments like this?
Well, that was really the hairiest moment of that race. You're referring to me leaving into the night at the first checkpoint, which happened to be a roadside checkpoint. So my family was there. It was almost like starting the real race from there. And right before I left, the race official said, "Hold up, we're rerouting you. There's an open lead in the river." And I couldn't believe it. And that's very unusual. What I was worried about was that dogs love to follow where dogs have gone ahead of them. That they follow the scent. Uh-huh. And so I thought, great, you know, if where the trail was an hour ago is now breaking up, what's going to keep them from going that way? But they must have really rerouted that trail. And I did get to the other side, and you know, I was launched in a flurry of adrenaline, but we got to the other side, and that's when I began to relax.
And where was your family in all of this? How did they feel about your decision to train for such a grueling event?
Well, my son finished the Iditarod before I had ever considered running it. He ran as an 18-year-old for a champion. He ran Martin Boozer's second dog team in 2001. And under the finish line arch, he said, "Mom, you have to do this." He and his sister Hannah were about to go off to college. There were 22 family dogs in our backyard who had been used primarily for our children in their fun junior racing club. And
did you say 22 dogs in the backyard?
Yes, we did, because as they got older, they needed more dogs to compete, you know, in whatever class they were in. So what started one dogging and two dogging turned into the five and the seven dog class, and then they each ran junior Iditarod, which is a 10-dog race. So they cried buckets leaving for college when they said goodbye to their dogs, and I thought, well, I better do something. So that was my Iditarod was in some ways an extension of our fabulous, fabulous years raising our kids with dogs. And the other part was sort of my defiant answer to the empty nest, which I was a little bit intimidated by.
So had you trained before? It sounds like your son was something of a star in the sport at a very young age. And were you, I guess, not a stage parent, but were you training or sledding yourself at all when he was?
Well, after we adopted Salt, we adopted more dogs. Each year we acquired some more. We had a one litter. And the dogs were primarily for Andy and Hannah's fun. But, of course, I took my turn racing, and I loved it. And Mark, my husband, is still the devoted support person. I mean, he built the sled. He makes the lines. He finished Iditarod also, but he is really enamored of being the support person in a sport which has got many, many dimensions. So this kind of happened to our family all at once.
We're talking with Debbie Clark Modrow. She's our guest today, talking about her new memoir, Fast Into the Night, A Woman, Her Dogs, and Their Journey North on the Iditarod Trail. I'm Emily Curitan, and you are invited to join our conversation. It's 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Debbie, have you trained a dog from a pup? I'm curious where the skill set to be a mush dog, a sled dog, comes from and when you start cultivating it.
The first time we put our young pups in harness, and usually it's to go for a walk around the block, they pull us. To tell one of these dogs not to pull is like telling a Labrador not to go into the water. I mean, this is just what they're put on this earth to do, and they make that pretty clear. I mean, they make it really clear. Once in a while, I have seen labs that are scared of water, and once in a while, I've had a dog that didn't want to pull, and they're wonderful companion animals, and we've placed a couple of those dogs as pets, and they live all over the country, actually. But we don't really put them in harness for pulling for any real distance until their second season, so usually they're a year and a half at that point. During their first year, if they're born, say, in the springtime, at this time of year, we might run them 5 or 10 miles in harness to teach them manners. We pair them with the older dogs on the line, so they've got canine mentors, and then we do a lot of preparatory training for them, too, by walking them in harness, and we socialize our dogs a lot. I mean, they all know how to sit. They know come. We spend a lot of time offline with them. I mean, they're really all around dogs.
Offline?
Well. Yeah, where we hike with them lots. Mm. We take our puppies on 3 walks a day. Our dogs get a very active custom life from the minute they're born until they die. And, you know, the old dogs are really important, too.
And they live to be, what, 14, 15, 16, something like that?
Well, Salt lived till he was 18. We've had several live that long. Usually they are able and very, very focused on running until they're at least 12. But we, again, treat each individual as exactly that. And if a dog shows signs of not being able to pull as well or not wanting to, then we put them on a different kind of a program. We have a big arena where we play with them. Like I said, we swim them in the summer, lots of them. Some don't like to swim, but those that do, we take them out swimming, and And when we know that one of them really wants a couch when they're 10 years old, we place them with other families.
Yeah, so the difference between a working sled dog and a pet, is it just that you don't let them in the house? For you, have you had dogs where you're like, okay, this is, you're a pet now, you know, you're in my home, or what is the line for you there?
Well, my best lead dog right now is lying at my feet, and she's my performing leader right now. So she is 9 years old, and so she sleeps in our bedroom, and she's leading me in 50-mile races. So that is not, again, it's all individual. Some dogs don't want to be in the house. We definitely customize ours to being inside so that they can live a pet life whenever that's best for them. So our dogs, you know, I grew up with hunting dogs that hunted with my dad, and they were pets also. And that's really the way we treat our kennel. But we have 20-some dogs. You know, the real competitors in the sport have much more, and many more dogs. And, you know, their answer might be a little bit different. But this is a very dog-centered event. The dogs are the heroes out there, not the mushers. And the dogs are way better suited for the trail than us. So we have to really work hard to keep up our end of the bargain.
So you write of your first attempt in 2003, talking about this is your first time doing the Iditarod. What's the age of most mushers? Did you feel like the average competitor?
Well, you know, I did, and I suppose I wasn't, but I did. the sport's interesting. Wisdom really matters. And so there are people that will be in the top 10 this year that are in their 60s. So this is a little different than other sports where athletic prowess of the musher or the competitor, be it an alpine skier or whatever, reigns, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Experience is really a trump card in this. So I was by no means the oldest person in the race. And so at 47, I was very concerned about keeping up my end of the bargain. So I got myself into really the best shape I'd been in my entire life. So no, I didn't feel old or weak in any manner.
Right, and of course, not my question. I'm just curious. I think wisdom really matters. Kind of sums it up. There are a few sports where you do have people in their 60s dominating, you know, at the highest levels. This is one of them. And in terms of being able to read your dogs, I would think that is a question of years and of wisdom. Of your first attempt, you wrote, probably maybe the darkest hour of the trek. I guess we'll leave that to you to decide. You wrote that despite your dog's body language, I know they can do it. How could you know that?
Well, when my dogs, my race faltered 200 miles short of the finish line. We'd gone 800 miles, and my dogs got out on the ice of the Bering Sea, and they lost their nerve to continue. And I, as much as I was very tired 10 days into the race, and when I get tired, my gauge from daring to doubt swings toward doubt, and I wondered what I'd done wrong or what I had missed. I knew they were thriving only 100 miles before, and so, and in much worse conditions in my mind. So I did know they could do it, but I also knew that I had lost my connection with them and that they were saying no to me. And there was nothing, there was no trick. You know, I run only on positive reinforcement. There was no trick that I had that was going to convince them that we were 2.5 days from Nome. And it was pretty devastating to lose my bond with them, which really is my strong suit. You know, I'm not the biggest person out there. I'm not the most experienced. My dogs are not the most carefully chosen or bred. We make it our purpose to make the best of what we've got. And so I really run this team on a lot of partnership, and clearly that was broken right then. And that nothing worse could have happened to me right then than lose my connection with my dogs.
And losing that connection, can you tell us more about that? Your leader was Conga. You've got, I presume, a different leader at your feet today as you talk to us. Was it the connection with the leader that fell through the year that your dogs essentially mutinied and you weren't able to complete the Iditarod?
You know, I'll never know for sure. I don't think that there's any question. Kanga is a moody, very competitive, was a moody, very, very competitive girl. super talented. And for some reason, she didn't like that sea ice right then. And I'm quite sure she communicated it to the others. Now, that doesn't mean that we should have shut down, you know? I mean, I could have carried her in my sled, but I don't know. It's almost like it was a virus and it just took hold all at once. Also, the landscape, my dogs, when I think back on that team, basically this was the outgrowth of a kids' junior racing team, and they'd always run in the woods, the forest, the twisty, winding trails in the country way south of the coast and in the interior of Alaska. And when I think back, there were some real sweethearts on that team. Most of them went on to live on couches and in pet homes. That just, you know, the dogs just loved every minute of that as well. And that was a tall order for a few of those dogs to go that far. It's a marathon, you know. Not every 10K runner is good at running 26 miles. You know, that's really what we were talking about. But yes, there was a dynamic with Kanga that affected the whole group. I'm quite certain of that.
And 800 miles in, finding yourself on sea ice, is that a particularly treacherous terrain? It seems like all the terrains we're talking about here are somewhat treacherous. Why do you think sea ice would psych a dog out the way that it did?
I think it's the wind that whistles high above. So, you know, the ice cracks. It sounds like a gunshot. There's salt in the air. There's a lot of trigger points for phobia if you're going to go there.
Well, we're talking with Debbie Clark Motorow, and about somewhat of a low point in a very high-flying career as a musher. She competed in the Iditarod, has done the race twice, attempted the race twice, completed it once. All of this is in her new memoir, Fast Into the Night, A Woman, Her Dogs, and Their Journey North on the Iditarod Trail. Much more to talk about with Debbie, and hopefully your comments and questions for her after a short break here on the Jefferson Exchange. Back on the Jefferson Exchange, it's 9:41 and our final segment. I'm Emily Curitan, talking today with Debbie Clark Motorow. She's written a memoir about her experiences with Alaskan dog sledding and competing in one of the most grueling and famous races in that field, the Iditarod. This year's race starts Saturday in Alaska. And you are welcome to join this conversation, talk with a woman who's got a very special connection to quite a number of dogs. It is 800-838-3760, or email us jx@jeffnet.org. So, Debbie, we were just talking about what happened in 2003, the very first year you attempted the Iditarod at age 47, a very warm year. The rivers, in fact, had either not frozen or were breaking up, and the route had to be changed from its traditional trail. Moving along, things didn't go as planned there. But you decide to go back 2 years later. What was your process between that failure in 2003 and your attempt again in 2005?
Well, in 2004, my husband Mark and I had agreed that he would run the Iditarod. And that felt absolutely the way it should be after my scratch in 2003. So in 2004, we together set out to get him to Nome. And he did make it. Some of the same dogs that had mutinied on me started giving him trouble. And so midwinter, we pulled them out of the training pool and we leased a few dogs that were veterans and who had finished Iditarod. And we wanted to ground our impressionable dogs that were somehow acting rebellious with some veteran wisdom on the line. Mark had a fabulous run very relatively smooth. And then the next year, I couldn't wait to go again because I wanted to finish what I had begun, but I insisted on taking the exact dogs. All the main players of my 2003 team, which included the ones that I was suspicious had caused our trouble. I was warned not to do that by veterans, but I wanted to take the same dogs. That's what it was all about for me.
Yeah, so it sounds like keeping your team together, again, this isn't about the glory so much as the connection with the animals.
That's right. So Kanga did not go with Mark. She went with me. So did Juliet, you know.
Right. I mean. And we got Taiga, Sue, Piney Creek, Nacho, Zeppi. you know, some of these, the names sort of don't betray how serious the task at hand is. About how many people start the Iditarod each year who don't finish the race, as you didn't in 2003?
You know, that varies according to the race and the weather and the training year. In 2003, I think there was something like a 40% scratch rate. It was really high, and I might be a little wrong on that, but it was very, very high. Other years, you know, it's more like 10%. So it does vary. But this Saturday, 85 mushers are taking off for Nome. So we'll see.
All right, 85 mushers in Nome. It's coming near the big day. Let's take a call. Robert in Ashland, you are on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to share, I wondered how much you heard about Leonard Sepla and the original carrying of the serum. When I was growing up in Seattle, about 10 years old, he lived up in my neighborhood. He had retired down there and used to stop off and hear stories from him about, you know, running the serum and all of his dog sledding over there. And of course, the big story is Balto got all the glory, and he'd left him behind in a pen because he was a freight dog. And someone else hitched him up and came out and picked up the serum about 20 miles out of Nome and carried it in, and Balto got the glory. But Togo was the real star of the race, as I recall Leonard telling him. So did you hear much about that up there?
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up. Oh, yes, we do. And I spoke to a group of school kids recently at Leonard Sepala Park, and there's a signage there telling that story and giving Togo a lot of glory. So that's a well-known story. What he's referring to is the 1925 outbreak of diphtheria in Nome, and a series of mushers relayed the serum to Nome to treat the children and really saved many lives in the process. Planes couldn't fly. The weather was terrible, but the dog teams came through. And we've got a picture of Leonard Sepala on our wall right here. I'm envious you got to talk to him.
Yeah, that's an incredible story. So we talk about getting the serum. It was literally life or death for so many people. Is that the same trail that we're running today?
For the most part, yes. There are some variations, but yes. The historic Iditarod Trail, over which that serum was taken, is part of the Iditarod race trail, the majority of it.
Let's take another call. We've got Jeannie in Eugene on the line. Hi, Jeannie. You're on the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi. Well, I caught the bug in 2007 because I have a friend who was a fourth grade teacher who used the Iditarod in her classroom. And so we've been up to Nome and seen the race and helped support a variety of mushers, and the connections with their dogs that this woman's talking about is just incredible. And indeed, I actually wanted to do the serum run, which was a sort of a reenactment of that 1925 non-competitive run. And last year, I was able to go with a group from Fairbanks called Pause for Adventure, and we started at Banana, which is where the serum had been delivered by train. And we went all the way out to Manly Hot Springs, which is about 90 miles. And this year I'm going back because it's just an amazing, amazing place to be behind a team of dogs.
That's awesome. You know, my epilogue is about the serum run. We went on the serum run in 2007 and with an Oregon team or two. Actually, there was a great team of, he might have been from Washington. Anyway, and you're part of the country. Wonderful team of Samoyeds went with us on that expedition. And we went tracing the historic route from Nenana to Nome, which was much like my 2003 race course. And instead of going around the clock, we ran 30, 40 miles a day and spent the night in schools. Mark went as a snow machiner with us. And our daughter Hannah elected to do this instead of Iditarod. She She saw enough of my trials out there, and I think she thinks she got smart and did the serum run instead. And I took they invited me at the last minute. We had enough dogs so that I could go too.
So that brings up an interesting point. Is competition an important part of your enjoyment of the sport? Do you need to have a timer running, or do you do it more just to get where you're going or enjoy the landscape or whatever your motivations may be?
You know, I think I speak for everyone in our family. For the most part, racing means doing the best we can with our dogs. In some shorter races, we've been competitive. I am certainly not competitive in the 400 and 1,000-mile races, 400-mile races and 1,000-mile races. But they're not exactly like camping trips either. But to take a dog team on a race is to go out there just with your dogs on a new course with support. You know, a trail is marked, you've sent provisions out ahead, and it represents the ultimate adventure that you can share one-on-one with your dog team. That's why I did it. It was to go far with my dogs across this incredible country and work through whatever came our way.
You mentioned doing 30, 40 miles a day instead of the race pace or the race cadence, mm-hmm. which is kind of go for 6 or 8, rest for 6 or 8, go for 6 or 8. How long does it take you to go 30, 40 miles an hour? 30, 40 miles an hour?
If you're going 30 or 40 miles and then you're resting till the next day, our team moves at 10, 11 miles an hour. So it takes 3.5, 4 hours. Now, I have to hold my dogs back if we're doing a 4-hour run and a 4-hour rest and another 4-hour run, you know, because you need to pace them. It's like you're not going to sprint the first half of a marathon when you've got the other half to run. So the musher really is the pace setter, in that we tell the dogs how fast they can go. But when you rest for 18 hours after a 40, you're going to clip through those 40s pretty quickly. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that.
And I'm going to reveal some additional naive thinking here, but how do you stop the dogs? I mean, they love to pull, right?
So we have a brake and we have a drag, which is often a track from a snow machine that we stand on to slow them down. And then we have two things they're called snow hooks. They're really like snow hook anchors, and you set them in the snow. This becomes a little problematic when you're running on ice, but there are ways to deal with that.
And you do complete the race in 2005, as we led with your time. I think it's interesting that the mushers, you don't keep track of your place, you know, relative to other people. You keep track of the time, and yours was 13 days, 19 hours, 10 minutes and 32 seconds. Can you share with us a couple of minutes out of that, what must have been an amazing 2 weeks?
Well, that second race, I had a lot more confidence. My dogs had gone through 3,000 training miles beforehand. I set out to show them everything that we might encounter out there. And I was a much better musher. I was more aware of my game, what I needed to do, what I needed out there, and how to manage it. Still, we ran into some trouble on the coast. My dog's fear of the sea ice did not go away in those 2 years between the races. And when I got to that finish line, we had gone through quite a lot, and it wasn't all pretty. And I felt such deep satisfaction, but I knew I wanted to write a book even before I got there. I wanted to honor these incredible dogs, and I wanted to make sense of what we'd worked through together.
And what did you work through together? I mean, lessons we've learned from our pets. I think everybody has them. But in your case, it sounds like they were a little bit more hard won.
Well, I mean, they were scared of the ice. We stopped and started. We went into wicked wind, and they ran beautifully through that. And then we'd get back on the ice, and they were intimidated. You know, the gift of the finish line wasn't purely the glory of getting there. The gift of the finish line to me was that it took that monkey off my back of what I considered failure and gave me that perspective of looking back over a 2,000-mile, you know, double adventure, and realizing that the heart of that journey lay in the struggles, where my dogs and I had to work it out. We had to find our balance. We had to find each other and get going again in a way that was very satisfying to both of us. And like I said, I don't play a pressure card, and you can't push a rope. That's a quote from a musher that was advising us when we first got in. And I think I'm changed from it. I mean, I really do let myself off the hook and feel like, you know what, I gave that my best shot. And there's a lot of great stuff right in doing that. That's kind of what I learned out there.
The takeaways. And do you plan to attempt the race again in your life?
I don't. I certainly could never have written the book if I were still running the race. But we have 25 dogs in our backyard. We're going on a trip week after next. I've been on a book tour for 3 weeks, and I'm crazy to get back to our kennel in Denali Park and be with the dogs. Cheddar, my leader, is right here with me now, but they're more waiting. And I'll go on 200-mile races. We'll go on expeditions probably, but I think the 1,000-mile races for Mark and myself are part of our past.
Okay, so anything else, any departing wisdom from someone with 25 dogs in their backyard?
Oh, I'm just the luckiest person around to have them, and to learn from them, the dynamic between them, on the line, the interactions individually with each one, and then the challenge of inspiring them and connecting with them as a team is so rich and so wonderful. And that really is why I wrote the book. It feels a little self-indulgent that I get to do this. I wanted to try to put into words what had happened along the way for me so that other people could appreciate these amazing canine athletes and friends.
Well, it's a wild ride, and we get to go on it in Debbie Modero's new memoir, Fast Into the Night, A Woman, Her Dogs, and Their Journey North on the Iditarod Trail. Debbie, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun talking to you.